Penguin Random House Audio presents On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. This is the author, Sarah Chase. This book is dedicated to my sisters, Eve Chase Lyman and Angelica Chase, without whom neither it nor I would be what we are. Prologue. Dismissing Corruption, June 27, 2016. A momentous ruling was handed down that day. Since morning they had gathered, carrying bullhorns, carrying signs cut out in the shape of Texas, signs with a uterus like the head of a longhorn steer, the photo of a fetus cradled aloft in two disembodied hands. Some chanted, some wore black. Some covered their mouths with red duct tape, life magic markered across the gag. They stood at the foot of the serried columns of the United States Supreme Court, which rises like a temple on Capitol Hill. They were there for the last announcements of the 2015 term. They were there for the abortion case, Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. The court was short then by one justice. The vote might be split. When the 5-3 decision came down, voiding a Texas law that required doctors who performed abortions to have hospital admitting privileges, a roar went up. Demonstrators fell into each other's arms, ecstatic mouths wide. A woman in a pale blue sundress dubbed her disappointment a little setback, a bump. The cascade of media coverage poured forth for days. It was important. But it's not the momentous ruling I'm talking about. There was another case decided that day, McDonald versus United States. That's the one I mean. It concerned the conduct of those who hold public office. It went to the heart of how a democracy should be run, but it got scant attention. Petitioner Bob McDonald was governor of the state of Virginia when he did what he did. During his race for that office in 2009, the CEO of a Virginia tobacco company, who was attempting conversion to pharmaceuticals, offered him rides to campaign stops on a private jet. The CEO's name was Johnny Williams. Williams's company had formulated a tobacco-based dietary supplement that was supposed to have anti-inflammatory properties and to help athletes with sore joints or injuries on the mend. Pamphlets and online comments swore that the tablets improved conditions from Alzheimer's to thyroid disease to traumatic brain injury, even rashes. But the pills had never undergone independent clinical trials. That's what Williams wanted from the victorious McDonald. Aboard the private jet again in the fall of 2010, Williams asked a new governor to set him up with whatever state official he needed to talk to get the University of Virginia to run the trials. McDonald directed his Secretary of Health and Human Resources to meet with his benefactor. The official, according to the Supreme Court opinion, was skeptical of the science. Williams kept trying. He took Mrs. McDonald on a shopping trip and bought her $20,000 worth of designer clothing. He listened sympathetically to her worries about rental properties the McDonalds owned in Virginia Beach, the mounting cost of their daughter's coming wedding. "The governor says it's okay for me to help you," Williams testified, she assured him. "But I need you to help me with this financial situation." He came across with a total of $65,000 in loans and cash gifts. He invited the gubernatorial couple to his multimillion-dollar vacation home, had his Ferrari delivered there for the McDonald's use, paid for the governor's golf outings, bought a Rolex just like his own for Mrs. McDonald to box up for her husband for Christmas. McDonald tried too. Sometimes his phone calls to subordinates came just minutes after a conversation with Williams. McDonald directed his Health and Human Resources secretary to send staff to listen to Williams's pitch. He threw a luncheon party touting Williams's product, at which the CEO handed out $25,000 checks to Virginia Public University researchers to cover the cost of writing grant proposals. In the midst of negotiating another $50,000 Williams loan, McDonald called around to find out why no such application had materialized. He hosted a healthcare industry reception so Williams could do more lobbying. He popped Williams's pills at a meeting with two state officials, urging them to list the product with medications covered by the state employees' insurance plan. Williams's gifts and loans continued, totaling in the end more than $175,000, plus vacations and such luxuries. On September 4, 2014, a jury in federal district court convicted McDonald on four counts of honest services wire fraud and conspiracy. Those are 18 U.S. Code 1343 and 1349, and seven counts of extorting property under color of official right and conspiracy, 18 U.S. Code 1951, all of which carry a maximum 20-year prison term. McDonald was sentenced to 2 years in prison, well below the prosecution's request, which was already at the low end of the federal sentencing guidelines' recommended range. He appealed. On July 10, 2015, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit ruled he had been, quote, duly convicted by a jury of his fellow Virginians. It affirmed the decision against him. All three judges on the panel joined the opinion. McDonald appealed to the Supreme Court. The ruling came down on June 27, 2016. That evening, I stood in my narrow kitchen with the radio on. It's how I love to end the day. A beer and slab bacon and a mess of vegetables in a skillet, an ear to the news. Just 4 days back, the people of the United Kingdom had reversed a half century of European history, voting to Brexit the Union. Presidential candidate Hillary Clinton had widened her lead over Donald Trump in a campaign that was careening from one dumbfounding episode to the next. And there was the end of the Supreme Court's 2015 term. Through the din, that's what I was listening for. For a decade, I had been working to combat corruption. I'd analyzed it in countries like Nigeria and Afghanistan, where I had lived for years after the terrorist attacks of 9/11. I had set up a small manufacturing cooperative in downtown Kandahar, Taliban country. We were women and men working together, a minor revolution. We were 9 different tribes and ethnic groups, 10 if you count me, in 20 people. With improvised bombs detonating sometimes every day, we bought apricot kernels in bulk and pressed wild pistachios and distilled essential oils and laughed our heads off as we mixed and kneaded and polished soaps to look like river-worn cobbles and concocted fragrant lotions and talked politics all day long. And I discovered something I would never have imagined. Religious fanaticism, these men and women told me, was not driving their friends and cousins into the arms of the extremist Taliban. Indignation at their government's corruption was, and at Americans' role in enabling it. It was a remarkable idea. I asked around, trying it out on other Afghans, trying to understand the structure of what I soon could see was a system. I went to work for the U.S. military leadership, serving 2 commanders of the international forces in Kabul, then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Pentagon. I helped launch the first anti-corruption efforts the United States undertook. In 2010, in response to an almost comically ambivalent plan put forth by the State Department, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen, my boss, persuaded his colleagues it was time, in his words, to get serious. He put me in charge of redrafting the plan. He passed the result to the Deputy National Security Advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan, Douglas Lute. And there it sat. Mullen retired at the end of 2011, and I left government. During those years, I discovered that the corrupt practices I had observed and victims' violent reactions were not just an Afghan anomaly. I traveled through the 2011 Arab Spring for Mullen. Banners brandished in protests across the breadth of a continent showed pictures of venal government officials behind bars. Later, on a research trip in Nigeria, I discovered that people applauded the Boko Haram militant group because of corruption, especially in the police. In Uzbekistan.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?